Hello, my name is Tim Schwartz, and welcome to the Life After Blindness Spotlight. This is the podcast where I interview someone who is connected to the blind and visually impaired community. Please join me as we explore their journey with a life after blindness. This week, my guest is Frank Fascio. Hello and welcome to the Life After Blindness Spotlight. I'm your host, Tim Schwartz, and this week I am joined by a gentleman who some of our regular listeners may remember from episode 3 of the Life After Blindness podcast, which you can find by going to lifeafterblindness.com/3. That was the episode where we covered the 2017 CSUN Assistive Technology Conference in San Diego, and my guest today was our interviewer on the spot there at the conference. He is also currently a federal employee with the United States Postal Service going on 35 years. He's also been very active with Bieber Baseball for the Blind and currently is the bass guitarist for the band Steel Horse Country. Let's take a moment to listen to some of one of the songs that they do. This one's called 5150.
Since I met you, girl, you've been on my brain. Can't think of nothing else but you both night and day. It's like I got a first-class seat up on Aussie's train. And it's driving me insane. 5150, somebody call the po-po. I'm going crazy, think about you, baby. 5150, just this side of low.
This week, my guest is Frank Fascio. Frank, thank you so much for being on the podcast.
Thank you so very much, Tim. I really appreciate being on this podcast again. I had a good time when we did the CSUN conference and you asking me if I wanted to be part of a spotlight interview. And I thought this would be kind of cool to tell people about myself and my story.
And I greatly appreciate the work that you did for us this year, helping to cover the CSUN Assistive Technology Conference. And I look forward to having you back on that podcast sometime in the future. Now, Frank, you have such a big and positive story to tell, which is why I wanted to have you on the spotlight so that people could listen to the journey that you've been on with your life after blindness. But of course, first, as I always do, I want to paint the picture of the person that you were before you lost your blindness, because you were a person who lost your vision later on. You weren't born blind. So let's go to the beginning, of course, and tell me where you were born and a little bit about where you grew up.
Well, I was born in Phoenix, Arizona, and that's where I grew up for the first 40 years of my life before I moved here to San Diego. But growing up as a kid, you know, being able to see and everything else, I did pretty much everything as a normal kid would do. You know, just go to school, play sports, things like that. Comic books. I was an avid comic book reader when I was a kid. I bought comics every week with my allowance. I wore glasses since first grade, but that had nothing to do with my blindness.
So you've talked to us a little bit so far about you enjoyed comic books and sports and things like that. Tell me a little bit more about Frank Fascio, the younger man. What kind of sports were you into? Were there certain movies or other interests that you were into?
Well, of course, I mean, I enjoyed movies, but you know, back then there was no such thing as VCRs and DVDs and CDs and everything else. It was basically cassette tapes, you know, and so, you know, we didn't go to the movies that often, you know, as a family or whatever. But, you know, I played basketball. That was probably the only sport. That was the only sport I excelled in. I was a skinny kid growing up. I was involved in my choir at school, in grade school and in high school. I played grade school and high school basketball. I also swam a lot. I was on the swim team at one of the public pools out here. You know, growing up, we were always swimming, my brother and my sister. We always were at the swimming pool pretty much every day in the summer. And we really enjoyed it. I mean, I was 6-8 hours a day at the pool, you know. And that was a lot of fun. and did ice skating as a kid, and you know, just all that different stuff. You know, that's what we did growing up, and I really enjoyed it. I was always outside. I enjoyed outdoor activities, not like camping or anything, but just outside and not being in the house. But that was me growing up as a kid, you know, going to school, playing sports, hanging out with my friends, bicycle riding, and we did rockets, you know, like the built the rockets and shot them off, and that was a lot of fun. Or we did the model airplanes where we flew them, and that's what I did growing up as a kid.
So now here you are, this kid living in Arizona, as you said, you know, involved in sports, swimming, basketball, you were in the choir singing. And then something happened in the gym that made you realize that maybe there was something different about your vision. Tell me about that experience.
The lighting isn't that good in high school gyms. The color schemes are similar. Like the floor is a lighter orangey color, wood color, and the bleachers are the same thing. The basketball is kind of orange. So they can all blend together, especially when they go into the shadows. And so there were times I would miss passes and things like that. And so, you know, my coach said, maybe you should have your eyes checked again or whatever. And I go, hey, no problem. I'll do that. And so we went to an optometrist and he checked out my eyes and made, you know, to see if we needed to improve my glasses. And then he said, well, maybe we should schedule you to see an ophthalmologist. And, you know, this was back in 1975. And so we went to a neuro-ophthalmologist, and they did the whole thing, the field vision, the dilation of the eyes, or everything that's done to your eyes when you have a checkup like that. And then that's when they said that they found these black pigments in my retina, and they weren't sure if they would go away or if they would get worse, because this was in 1975, where retinitis pigmentosa was not really well known back then. So he wasn't sure, and so I said, okay, well, I mean, what am I going to do about it? I mean, if he didn't know, or if he didn't think it would clear up, or he wasn't sure if it would or not, I mean, I'm a 17-year-old kid. I didn't need to worry about that stuff. And so, you know, that was my first experience with knowing about RP, but there wasn't much information about that back then.
But I can see where, as a 17-year-old, like you talked about, that could be a little bit of a wake-up call, because I know, like you said, you were wearing glasses before then, so it's not like eye issues were a mystery to you because you had to wear glasses, but to have something else thrown at you and said, oh yeah, by the way, the reason why you're maybe not seeing into the shadows with the basketball or whatever, it's this disease, it's this retinitis pigmentosa. What were kind of your first thoughts and maybe your family's first impressions when you heard about this and what it could become?
My thoughts were, okay, I have this. And see, for me, I take kind of like a nonchalant attitude. And it's not like this all the time, but when it's something that I am powerless to do anything about, it's like, okay, it's there. I'm not going to let it rule my life. And of course, that's what I do today. But back then, I didn't really think that way. But I kind of just roll with the flow. And that's how I always looked at things, rolling with the flow. A lot of times my parents took it harder. My mom, especially, because we found out she was a carrier. So she took it a lot harder, but we didn't know if I was going to go blind or not back then. The doctor didn't even know. So my concerns were not that earth shattering or hard or anything like that. It was just, okay, so I can't really see too well in shadowy areas, and I'll adjust. There's the rolling with the flow part. And that's the attitude I had.
And I think that attitude is evident in what happens going forward with your story. So from there, you finish up high school. Now, your senior year of high school, you did not continue playing basketball, correct?
Yeah, because the coach suggested that I should maybe try out. And, you know, and he was really nice about it. He was a cool guy. I really liked my coach. He was a cool guy. But what was interesting was I was still part of the team. I did stats for him and I, you know, cause it rebounds and this and that. I was taking the stats and giving him the stats. And so I went to all the games. I was part of the team still, but not playing.
That was nice of him to help out to make sure that you were still feeling part of something and being part of the team.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, I was still playing basketball, you know, during gym time or whatever. I mean, I was still holding my own against these guys. But what was really cool, which I didn't even expect, was when we had the banquet, you know, for the team and everything, that I got a high school letter for doing that. He gave me my high school letter.
Oh, very good.
In basketball.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I thought that was really cool and it was really nice. And I still have it somewhere. And I thought that was really cool and, you know, very touching to get that. To me, that was really a really big deal to get that letter.
Absolutely. Now, from there, you graduate high school, you go into college, and still during this period of time, even though you've been diagnosed with retinitis pigmentosa, and as you said, just having minor issues that maybe you weren't even necessarily noticing all the time, you weren't really having any other issues during that time, were you, through the end of high school and into college?
Oh, no, not at all. As far as my blindness or anything, it wasn't even getting worse at that time either. I mean, I had a hard time adjusting from light to dark. That would take several extra seconds or maybe even a half a minute or whatever. I was even working as a lifeguard back then. I took the lifeguard, you know, advanced life-saving and got a job for the city of Phoenix. And I worked as a lifeguard for 6 years, and I even taught swimming lessons. I was still able to see and do that. You know, that didn't really affect anything during that time period in working as a lifeguard. And going to school and everything else. So, I mean, that was fine. Everything was good during that time period.
At some point in there, I know that you stopped going to college and had different aspirations for a career than what you ended up actually doing. You also had a couple of other major transitions occur at that point, not just personally, but with your career. So if you could talk a little bit about that period of time and what happened next.
I stopped going to college about 1980-ish. I didn't know what I was going to do. I wanted to be, actually at that time, I wanted to be a paramedic. I wanted to be involved in health. I wanted to be an EMT. So in college, I took the basic EMT classes. I was even certified as a basic EMT for the state of Arizona at that time. And I thought, well, you know, why not get involved in maybe dispatching and everything else? At that time, I had met my then wife and had a son. And so my concern at that time was, is he going to get RP or things like that, you know, because it is hereditary. And so, you know, that was somewhat of a concern, but it wasn't like there every day. It was just something I would think about every now and then. But, you know, I wanted to become a paramedic, and that kind of went by the wayside because of my eyesight. You know, it was starting to get a little bit worse back in the early 80s. Even at night, more night than anything else. But it was then I was still able to do a lot of stuff still. I was still able to do what a sighted person would do in their everyday life. So I went through a few transitions there. And then I had my dad, who was a mail carrier for the United States Postal Service for 30 years. He says, you know, hey, they're looking to hire people. Why don't you take the test? So I took the test. I actually took it a couple of times. And then they finally called me, the post office called me in 81 and did the interview and all that. And they said, okay, you know, you're on the books and we're in a hiring freeze right now. But as soon as it's lifted, you know, we'll be giving you a call. So I should have been hired in October, November of 81, but I didn't get hired until May of 82. And that's when I started my postal career.
So then there you are getting that position with the Postal Service. And at that point, shortly after, you now have two children. So talk to me about what went through your mind at that point when you know you have this disease that's not really affecting you too much yet. It's starting to, but you also know that it's hereditary. What were your thoughts and feelings about it at the time when here you are having two children of your own that potentially could someday get RP?
Well, my daughter was born about 2 weeks before I started at the post office. My daughter was born on May the 4th, and I started at the post office on May 17th in 1982. So here, another child, and my son was already 2.5 roughly. And I thought about, well, you know, I don't know if these kids or my kids are going to be affected by this or not. They still didn't know. I mean, I would get my eyes checked every now and then, and it looked like it was getting worse. You know, they do the field vision test and all this other stuff. But still, I kind of rolled with the flow. I mean, I could still do whatever I wanted to do. yeah, at night it was harder to see, like going into a bar or a dark place, you know, not like it was 10 years earlier when I was a kid. But it was getting worse, but still I was able to do pretty much anything still. And, you know, like one of my concerns was, you know, are my kids going to get RP, which they couldn't tell me anyway. I mean, they still didn't even have that much information, even in the early 80s. Well, I can tell you today, my kids are in the mid-30s now, and they don't have RP. They don't have any eye issues whatsoever, although they wore glasses, but, you know, so did my wife, and so did myself when I was growing up. And I also have grandchildren, and to my knowledge, they don't have any RP issues at all whatsoever. So there are different forms of RP, and mine is the one that I think is a recessive gene. So it kind of just pokes its evil head every generation or so. No one in my family that I knew of, and it was on my mom's side because nobody on my dad's side didn't have any eye issues. But to my knowledge, no one in my family on my mom's side was blind. And so my kids aren't. So we don't know if it'll pop out again. My brother and sister don't have it. Their kids don't have it. So what I tell people today is that I won the blind lottery. So I know it's kind of odd for me to say something like that, but it is true. It's like I was the one that got it. You know, why me? Why not somebody else? Why not somebody else in my family? My brother, my sister, my cousins, you know, things like that. So I just tell people I won the blind lottery.
It's definitely one way to look at it. Absolutely. So when you got contacted after taking the post office test a couple of times and they gave you that call to say, come on in, we're going to have you work here at the post office. Like we've already covered, you were diagnosed with RP, but it wasn't even affecting you too badly at that point. It was progressing, but not preventing you from doing too much just yet. What kind of things were you doing for the post office at that time?
When I was contacted, I had to go through like tests and interview process and everything. And I even had to take a medical exam kind of a thing. And here's where the RP, I don't even know if it was an RP related issue. It could just been my eyes type of thing, but we had to do an eye test. And one of them was looking into kind of like a microscope type of thing, but it was looking in there to see a picture. And we had to tell them, there were four squares, and one of the squares was a checkerboard square. We had to tell them which one it was. So I was having a hard time seeing that. So the nurse was really nice, and she said, well, why don't you go get your eyes checked to make sure the glasses are right and everything. And I did, and I came back, and I took the test, and I think there was one that I missed, but I think she kind of gave it to me. So that was an issue, like, man, I mean, what if I missed that? Or what if she was not who she was and I failed that test? And I did tell them that I had retinitis pigmentosa as well, that I had an eye disease. So they didn't know up front what I had. But, you know, I often imagine sometimes like what would have happened had she failed me. My 35-year career would never have existed. So, you know, of course, I didn't know that at that time, but I mean, I was so happy and grateful that she did, because I got this job. It was a well-paying job. It still is. I'm benefits, you know, working for the government at that time, you know, very important for my family and myself at that time. So I'm so grateful that I got that job and have still been with the post office now 35 years.
And so during your years at the post office, I'm sure between the years there in the beginning where you still had functional vision and now to the point where you have none, there's been, I'm sure, many transitions with your work and the things you've been expected to do. So for those early years, what kind of things were you doing with the post office?
I first was hired there to become a LSM operator, which LSM means letter sorting machine. And so what you have to do as an LSM operator is there is an arm, like a mechanical arm with a suction at the end that picks up a letter, brings it forward, drops it in front of you, and you have to, depending on the job that you're doing as an LSM operator, either look at the zip code or read the address, punch in a couple of numbers and send it on its way. And you have to do one a second, 60 a minute. So we had to train for that. And I had to learn a scheme. And what I mean by that is the job I had, I was a scheme operator. So I was given a zip code that I had to learn all the streets in that zip code, the number, the numbered streets, the named streets, all the addresses, not each individual addresses, but sections, you know, and things like that. And the carriers, depending on the number of carriers that were in that zip code, depending on how big the zip code was, you had to learn where the carrier stopped at what address and when the next carrier started at the next address on the same street. We had to memorize all this stuff. Memorization was really important. And thank goodness that I had a very good memory. So I had no issues memorizing this kind of stuff. So that's what I did. I was started as an LSM operator. And I did that for about 6 months or so. And then when Christmas came around, some of you that are listening to this podcast may or may not know, but there's, you know, Christmas cards come in all different colors, you know, the envelopes, you know, anywhere from blues and greens and reds and yellows and dark brown, darker colors. And sometimes when people address these Christmas cards on a dark letter, they use dark ink. And so sometimes it's hard to read the address. So that was basically my downfall for being an LSM operator, is I had a hard time reading the Christmas cards and sending them on its way. Typewritten stuff was not a big deal. I mean, I could still read it, was no big deal. So from there, I had to go and become a manual clerk by casing mail by hand in cubby holes, depending on the zip code or the addresses or the carrier number or whatever, you know, what I was doing. So that's what I did. I was a manual clerk, and I did that for many years at the post office doing letters. And then I became a manual clerk doing flats. And what I mean by flats is your bigger envelopes, magazines, newspapers, anything that's not in letter form that's big, you know. So that's what I did for a few years. But at that time, my eyesight was getting worse.
Tell me about how, in those early days at the post office, you had to stop driving.
I had to quit driving in 1984 because it got to the point where cars were popping in front of me with, you know, driving down the street. I would blink and all of a sudden there was a car there. And unfortunately, I got in 3 accidents that year, but fortunately, nobody was hurt but just the vehicles. But that was kind of like a wake-up call. It was like, okay, I'm going to have to quit driving here, because I'm either going to kill myself or kill somebody else. So it was a big time. I mean, that was a hard time right there, because to lose your independence in driving. I mean, I could go wherever I wanted to with a car. And so I quit driving Christmas Eve. I went shopping during the day. I came home. I gave my dad the car keys, and I go, here you go, Dad. I can't drive anymore. I quit driving. And he could not accept my blindness. My dad could not accept my blindness, you know, but he was always there to support me. So my dad did a great job in my earlier years as I was going blind, but that was a big deal, quitting driving back at that time. But, you know, this is a transition right here where, okay, I am going blind now. I had to quit driving. It was getting hard to read comic books. It was getting hard to read because I can only read like one or two words at a time. And if the lighting was not bright enough, I couldn't even read in dimmer lighting because it was harder to see. So, you know, did I get angry? No. Did I cry? No, I didn't even cry then. Or I mean, nothing. I still rolled with the flow, even though it was harder. And I just accepted it. And so that was a big time period right there in 84, 85, 86. To where I had to change job positions at the post office. I quit driving. I started dating this gal that said, well, you need to learn Braille and all this other stuff. And I didn't want to do it. I didn't want to do it. I guess that was probably my denial period, even though I wasn't denying my blindness. I just wasn't ready to go learn Braille and all this other stuff at that time. But I did. And I met a wonderful lady in Arizona that was the head of the Department of Arizona Rehab Department of Rehab Services there, Joan Ellis, wonderful lady, and she taught me Braille, taught me how to cook and laundry and how to figure all this other stuff. And then Rob Cagle was my mobility instructor, and he was awesome. And you know, when you have to start asking for help, you have to learn how to swallow that pride bullet kind of thing. And I did, and I'm glad I did. If you're blind and you're out there and you need help, but you're too proud to ask for it, then you're pretty silly, because if you got to get around or if you got to go get things done, you better ask for help. And I don't have a problem doing that.
So there you are, swallowing your pride and working through yet another transition. And then you're introduced back in the sports. Tell me about that.
Joan told me about this game called Beat Baseball. And I said, hey, if there's a sport that I can play being blind and still do, be kind of free and, you know, still be in sports, I'm there. And so I first got my taste of Beat for Baseball in 1988 in Phoenix, Arizona. Went out. I didn't know what to expect. I wore jeans and tennis shoes, you know, and a t-shirt or whatever. And then I met these other blind people. This was probably my first experience with other blind people as well, was this sport that I got involved in 1988. So here I was by myself. Didn't know any other blind person at that time. And I met some blind people. And started asking them questions about how they deal with this and deal with that. And, you know, then I got involved in the game that I absolutely loved. I still love today. And I was, like I said, I was so grateful for Joan Ellis to being able to open up doors that were closed, you know, in other aspects of my life, but being able to do things like this, audio books, you know, the Beat Baseball. I mean, I still went to the movies and I could still see some then. I could still see, you know, but my vision was getting narrower. But I could still see. I just couldn't see at night. But I could still see movies a little bit and, you know, and do things like that. I even went skiing, backing up a little bit. I even went skiing in 1984, snow skiing, never skied ever in my life. But I followed somebody down the hill. But I did well because prior to skiing, I was still, you know, I was ice skating and water skiing. So snow skiing was really no different, just longer skis, but no different in balancing issues and everything like that. So I did, that was the only time I ever snow skied was 1984, but I had fun doing it. So, you know, I was still able to do some activities because I could still see. I didn't go totally blind then. It was just getting harder to see things and my eyesight was getting worse, but I could still function somewhat. I just couldn't drive anymore and I had to learn Braille and had to learn all this other stuff. But you know, then I got involved in Beat Baseball, and because of Beat Baseball and being other around other blind people, I saw blind people with dogs, and I started asking questions about guide dogs and everything else. And that's, you know, that's when, not at that time in 88, but after a few years and being involved in Beat Baseball and hanging out with other blind people, I said, well, maybe I should get a dog. Because I was transitioning at the post office at that time to where I couldn't read the letters anymore. My vision got to the point where I was only reading like one letter at a time from a word or one address number at a time. And we're talking 1988, 89. So from there with the post office, I went into marketing, and I did express mail marketing where I would make phone calls. They got me a computer that could talk. I had the large print thing because I could still see large print. And I could, and of course I had to have the white on black instead of the black on white type of thing. And people with RP or different kinds of vision that need the CCTVs like that would understand what I'm talking about. So I could read stuff underneath there, and that's how I was able to make phone calls at that time and do things like that. So at that time I wanted to try to get a guide dog, and I was going through a transitional period at work where it allowed me some more free time to go get one done. So I went and got my first guide dog in 1992, in November of 92, at Guide Dogs of the Desert in Palm Springs, California, a German Shepherd named Kelly. And that was my first guide dog. And I've had three others since then. So I'm currently on my fourth one now. But guide dogs definitely, to me, opened up a whole new set of independence that I never had with my cane, although I did everything under the sun with my cane as well. But I really believe that getting a guide dog allowed me more, especially at work, because then I could go back out on the floor and they didn't know what to do with me, because they wanted me to retire on medical disability years earlier because I was going blind. But I said, no, there's still things I can do here. And when I wanted to go back out on the floor, they didn't understand, like, what are you going to do out there? You can't see, you're blind. I go, I'm sure there's something I could do. So this guy, a union rep, called me one day and said, hey, why don't you come down here to work and let's see what we can find for you out on the floor. His name was Roger. And had he not called me, Tim, to be honest, I don't know what would have happened at that time, because I was kind of like in a transition phase there. And had he not called me and brought me to the floor to first introduce me to the DBCS, which is called Delivery Barcode Sorter, DBCS, I never would have found that machine. And I told Roger, this is my machine. I'm going to work this job. And we're talking 1993. And I've been doing that job ever since then. I still work on the DBCSs. So there again was a big turning point, I guess you could say, Tim, you know, in my life. You know, in 1982 was with that nurse. And had she not passed me, who knows what would have happened. But and the other turning point was Roger and having me come out. We looked at other jobs and we made a list of jobs that I could do with some modifications. So it wasn't just the DBCS. There were other things there that I could have done. But there was that turning point right there in 1992. And had he not called me, who knows what would have happened with me at that time period. I may have had to been forced into retirement, or who knows. So, you know, we all have these kind of turning points in our lives. And those were two of them right there. Well, three of them, actually, talking about blind baseball in 1988 and wanting to get my dog and coming back out on the floor, and Roger taking me out there. And I didn't have my dog at the time. This was before I got my dog. But finding these jobs and finding the DBCS, which has been my home since 1993 at the post office.
So when you first started playing beat baseball and then later got set up with your first guide dog, what, if anything, do you feel you may have gained from those experiences as a blind person?
Well, when I first went to beat ball practice, my thing was independent. Here I'm playing a game of baseball. Yes, it's been modified for us and everything else, but yet I had the feeling of independence there, where I could hit the ball and run to the base without any assistance. Yes, I would go to the buzzing of the base, and that would be my only assistance, obviously, because we had to find the base. But to be able to do that, or to be out in the field, and when the ball's hit your way and you hear that beeping ball and nobody's out there saying, left, right, move forward, move back, I'm using my ears to go get it. That feeling of independence, that feeling of being free, of playing a game, and just an awesome feeling. It really is an awesome feeling. And I could still see. I mean, I could have taken my blindfold off and saw the ball coming and sort of, you know, on the ground or whatever, but I could still see. So it wasn't like I was totally blind yet. And I do mean yet. But, you know, I was not totally blind at the time, but the feeling of independence is what I felt. And when I went and got my first dog, I mean, I was independent with my cane. Don't get me wrong. I was using my cane for 6 years. I was a fast cane user. I could tell you stories about being a cane user and things like that, of how many canes I've broken because I would walk so fast down the sidewalk and everything else.
Sure.
So it wasn't like I was not independent as a blind person, you know. But I really felt that when I got my first dog, my independence increased even more. And so the feeling of getting my first dog and the excitement of getting a dog, because I love dogs. You know, I had several growing up as a kid. But I knew that it was going to be a responsibility as well. But like children, dogs are like children. You have to take care of them. And so that feeling of becoming even more independent, because I could just grab my dog and just take off, you know, and the same thing I did with my cane as well. But I knew that by getting this dog, I really felt that my Pulsar career would still, I could extend it even more, because working on a workroom floor, it's kind of like a factory type setting. So there's a lot of things going on. And yeah, I could probably manage using my cane, but I felt more comfortable that I think a guide dog would be a lot better navigating through whatever obstacles there might be out on the workroom floor and this and that. So to me, the feeling of independence is what I felt, Tim.
That newfound independence probably felt a little bit different for you at the time. Could you tell me more about what that was like for you?
Obviously, I found more independence, obviously, with beat baseball, guide dog, a cane traveler, still maintaining my employment. But it's still, you know, I still miss driving. You know, I gained independence in a different way, I guess you could say, Tim. I gained the independence by being able to still go out and do what I want. Yeah, of course, I would have to take the bus. I rarely took taxis. So it was either the bus or friends, you know, taking me in places and everything else, or my dad, my brother and sister, or whoever, mostly my dad and my friend. So that's, you know, I gained some independence. I mean, I was able to go to the gym, took the bus to the gym, would work out, come home, you know, because I started working out, you know, basically, you know, because growing up as a kid, I told you I was really skinny and everything. And outside, when I got out of college and I started working in the post office, I started working out really heavily. And I wanted to get into bodybuilding. So I got bigger from a skinny kid to a big guy. So I was able to take the bus to the gym. You know, I would work out there either by cane or memorize the gym. It was smaller gyms. And, of course, I would, you know, with my dog, when I started getting my dogs, I was going to the gym then at the time. So, yeah, my freedom of independence was there big time. And even though I couldn't drive anymore, which was a bummer because, you know, being able to just take off and go wherever, I had to do things differently. But I still made it work, Tim. I'm the kind of person today, but even back then, that I just not want to stay home and do nothing and say, well, I'm blind, I can't do anything. I'm going to stay home, do nothing. I was that kind of person that wanted to go out and just live, basically live and enjoy life, which is really important.
Frank, I know that there was also something else about that particular period of time that you wanted to mention to the listeners, because unfortunately, not all transitions are positive, especially when you're losing your vision. So go ahead and talk about that.
At that time period, we're talking about 1990, 91. I do want to say that my blindness got to the point where that was pretty much the last time I saw my kids' faces. So that was kind of a bummer. That was to the point where I couldn't see faces anymore. That's when my blindness went to another level, so to speak. Being able to not see faces and people anymore. And so that was about the last time I saw my kids' faces, was the early 90s. And so I had to, you know, make another transition and a change and to adjust that, being not being able to see people's faces and things anymore. So it was a bummer back then about that time. But I got over it and life went on, but I just wanted to say that.
And I'm glad that you did, because I think that's a really important milestone to mention. Now, with all of that happening after finding your new independence in so many ways, talk to me about any other major transitions that were happening to you during that time in the 90s.
Well, I stopped playing beat baseball for a period of time for around 5 years, and I won't get into any of what happened. Let's just say there was a disagreement, so to speak. And so I stopped playing. I really still wanted to play. I reached out to another team. This was back in 91. And I reached out to another team in 92, and they never contacted me. So I basically let that go. You know, I roll with the flow. I basically let it go. I missed it. I really wanted to play. But, you know, life goes on. And I had a girlfriend at the time that I had met. And so she basically got laid off of work at the bank that she was working at. This was in 96. And she found another job out in San Diego. And so that was a really big turning point in my life. I mean, we're talking everything I knew about Phoenix, Arizona, growing up. My family had been there since before Arizona became a state. That's how long my family's been there. And I told her, I said, well, I would love to come out there. I mean, I was still enjoying my job at the post office, but there was just negativity there at the post office. And I was just not happy there. I was still happy with my everyday life, you know, my kids and my girlfriend and whatever. But my job at the post office, I wasn't happy there because it was just negativity. And at that time, I had my second dog, which was Dylan, was my black lab. And so she got this job out here. And I said, well, I will do what I can to try to transfer out there from Arizona to San Diego. And so in 96, I came out Thanksgiving, had an interview with a senior plant manager. Tom was his name. And he interviewed me and whatever the case, because this was a special circumstance, because we're talking about a blind person working for the post office. This is not an everyday occurrence. I set a precedent when I kept my job at the post office. I set a precedent when I started working on the DBCSs, a machine with moving parts and how can they work in this machine, because I could get injured and hurt. I set all those precedences. So the senior plant manager was the one I had to talk to, because he was the one that had to make this decision. And this was a big decision, Tim, because here is a blind man sitting in his office. And here, this guy had to make this decision on whether to allow me to come out to San Diego and start working in his plant processing mail. So he was the one that I had to talk to. And apparently I did fine, because he allowed me to transfer or do a detail. We decided to do a detail to see if I was going to be able to, not so much do the job. I had already proved myself in doing this job, but being able to learn this building as a blind person, because the building that I was in prior, I knew as a sighted person before I lost my sight. It was the same building that I'd been in for years. How well would I have learned this building and what I know, you know, north and south and which way things were at and everything. So this was a big deal, Tim, to go from one state to another, one city to another. Big turning point in my life right here.
Absolutely.
And so, but I had every confidence in myself that I knew I could do, I could do anything, basically. And so when I came out to San Diego in February of 97, started working on the machine, I could tell right away that this was a place for me, because everybody received me with open arms there. Everybody. All the way from Tom Wilson, the senior plant manager, to the custodian. All people would say, hello, hi, how are you doing, or introduce themselves. Talk about night and day, where the post office in Phoenix, and I'm not trying to disrespect the post office, it was just attitudes there in Phoenix. The people working there, the attitudes were so bad. But when I got to San Diego and started working at the post office here, the attitudes were different. They were welcoming, happy, smiling, happy Friday, good morning, all this other things, you know. So the transition worked really well. You know, I learned the building. And of course, now as a blind person growing up, you know, being sighted and knowing your town, knowing where cities, streets were, knowing where businesses were because you could see them, going to a city that you didn't know anything about. How am I going to get around town? How am I going to be able to memorize streets and learn where I'm going and things like that? So that was a big deal. It is a big deal for any blind person, whether you were born blind or sighted when you were born and went blind later on in life, going from moving from one city to another, one state to another, is a big deal. So I had to deal with that as well. And, you know, I did. I mean, obviously, I'm still here in San Diego after 20 years this year. I'm still here. And I was able to learn my building, learn the city. I don't know everything about San Diego, but everywhere I go, I make a mental map in my head as to how to get there. So the places I do know, I know well, and I know how to get there. So that was a big deal. Moving in with my girlfriend at the time was a big deal. But, you know, life does change and relationships change. And so moving ahead, I met this woman in 2004, which is now my wife. Her name was Rosie. And so, you know, she had never been around a blind person, someone who couldn't see. And so this was a big deal for her too. But she is a great woman. She deals with it. She's a very caring person. And, you know, she deals with it. She deals with life and stress and everything. And she was able to, you know, obviously deal with me and my issues and whatever issues I don't have, but, you know, blind stuff.
Yeah. Tell me about those early days with Rosie, because I'm sure that that was a different kind of dynamic where you're going into a relationship with someone who only knows you as blind, as opposed to relationships you had been in the past where they knew you when you had vision.
Well, I had always been going out with sighted women anyway. So to me, on my end, was not a big deal, you know, but to other women that I had met throughout, you know, my adult life, it is a big deal, because, you know, they're going to have to take care of me. They're going to do everything for me. I mean, all these questions do pop up, you know, and, you know, in the blind community, so to speak, a lot of blind people date other blind people and marry other blind people. Well, I never, I guess, had that opportunity, or, you know, it was never there for me to not take advantage, but to experience, so to speak. So with Rosie, she had to learn my ways as far as how to do things. And sometimes she forgot, or she would leave something out and I trip or whatever. And I said, well, you got to, you know, let me know what's there. And if I forget, it's my fault, you know. And so she had to learn, you know, she definitely had to learn. And she still does, even today after 10 years, you know, well, 13 years now or whatever. We've been married since 2010. But she still has to. She sometimes forgets, because I get around so well that some people, they forget I'm blind. Even wherever I go at work, I get around so well, they just forget that I can't see. I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing, but it's just there. They mention that to me. Well, you get around so well, I forget. And I'm sure you might have experienced that yourself.
I have, yes.
And so even with your wife too, I'm sure. You know, well, you get around so well, they just assume that I can see still. So, you know, it was hard for Rosie. It still is sometimes, but it's a lot easier for her now. I allow her to do more things for me because that's what she wants to do. I don't know about your wife, but, you know, that's what she wants to do. And so maybe I take advantage without taking advantage, because it's sometimes a lot easier just for her to do it instead of me saying, no, I can do it. Because I still want my independence. I still want to do stuff.
Frank, why don't we pivot there just slightly and tell me about you and Rosie and music.
During that time period, because she's a musician, and, you know, we haven't really talked about my talents of singing and everything, but I've been singing since grade school choir, college, high school choir, and college choir. And of course, in 92, that's when I got my first taste of karaoke. And I've been singing karaoke for years coming into San Diego, but never was I with a band. I didn't know how to play an instrument. I dabbled with a guitar in the 90s, but didn't really quite pick that up. And then I met Rosie, and she's a musician. She plays flute. She knows all about that stuff. Her prior two husbands were musicians as well. So during that time period, you know, when her and I were dating and everything else, I met Corey and Laura on this website called All in Play, which I'm not sure if you're familiar with that website or not. It was a website where they had games for the blind and everything. This was back in 2004, five.
Yeah, I remember it.
So I met Corey and Laura in 2006 on this website. And they said they were in San Diego, and I said, cool. He said, you want to come hear the band play? I got a CD release party. He put out a CD, and I said, sure. So Rosie and I went to go see them play. And when we didn't know what to expect, and so when we went to go see them play, and we met another couple, one of them was blind, from the same website, living in San Diego. They met us there, and we saw Corey and Laura with his band, and they rocked, man. They were awesome. These guys were talented, you know, and so Rogie even said so as well. So we became good friends, and we started becoming good friends, hanging out with them, going to see some of their shows. So, we hung out a lot, and then one day I told Corey, I said, Corey, we should get a band together. I want to get involved in a country western band. He goes, yeah, let's do that. You know, because he was a guitar player, singer, and his sister Laura was a drummer. So I said, well, we need to find a bass player. And he goes, well, why should we pay for another player when you can learn how to play? And I didn't want to learn an instrument. Here I was, 48 years old, 49. I didn't want to learn how to play an instrument. And so I didn't want to do it. He says, well, you know, why should we do that? You can learn it. Yeah, you can learn how to play. So we went to Guitar Center, bought my first bass guitar, Fender Precision, and a little amp, spent about $400, and we went over to Corey's house at night. He taught me my first song in 10 minutes on the bass guitar. It was Knocking on Heaven's Door by, Bob Dylan.
Right.
And I kind of knew the fretboard because I dabbled with the guitar in the 90s, so I knew strings and what each string was, what note they were, and if I pressed on a certain part of the fretboard what notes they were, and so I kind of had an idea. So that's why I was able to learn that first song so quickly in 10 minutes. And so I said, wow, this is pretty easy. I only have to deal with one note at a time. I don't have to strum chords. I don't have to do this and do that, because it was just, not that it was hard, because if you don't know how to play guitar, obviously anything, it's hard at the beginning. So I did that, and that's how we started forming the band that I have today. And I do have to say, about that time when I started learning how to play bass guitar, I took a handful of lessons from a guy here, San Diego, Tony. But what really helped me out in learning music was Bill Brown. We have to give a plug to Bill Brown. I don't know if you've ever heard of this man or whatever, but I went online to find lessons for the blind, audio lessons to learn how to play an instrument, bass guitar, and to see if there was anything out there for audio lessons. Yeah, there was videos, but these instructors weren't telling you where to put your fingers, and things like that. So I found Bill Brown out of Georgia. I called him up. He did a series of lessons for the blind, and basic lessons on how to play piano and guitar and harmonica, bass, and all this stuff. So I called him up, told him what I wanted, what I was looking for, and he goes, well, I don't know if this will work for you because this is intro to the bass guitar. It's really basic. I just go through really basic stuff, but I do talk about genres of music and what to recognize and everything. And it was a 4-CD set and $40. And you know what, Tim? It was the best $40 I ever spent. Talk about spending money and the quality of what you're buying when you're spending that money. Well, this $40 was basically unlimited. It were very valuable $40 because once I listened to the CDs and learned what he was talking about when it came to patterns and music, and everything just clicked in, and I started learning music at a rapid pace after that. So my growth spurt happened big time after I started listening to these CDs back around 2007-ish, I guess, or so. And the band got going, Steel Horse Country, and 2008 was our very first gig, was my 50th birthday, and we've been playing ever since, and we've had a few bandmates, ever since, but, we've gotten better and better and better, and I've gotten better and better, and it's been a big, fun ride playing with a band and playing music with Steel Horse Country and Corey and Laura. We've been the basic main core group for 10 years. And that says a lot because, you know, bands change over the years. Or there's always band drama. You know, we hear about band drama and stuff. And we were, I just got lucky. I got lucky. And so it's been a great ride with these guys. And who knows how long we're going to play. But I still want to play. And it's all new to me. And I'm having a good time. And we get a lot of gigs. And, you know, we, you know, people really love the kind of music that we play, no matter where we go. We were at a gig on Thursday, a couple of days ago, and this one gal came up to us and she said, you know, I don't like country music, but I like your country.
Well, Frank, I think this is a good time to play some more of that country. I've got another song here that features your friend Corey on vocals called Play Something Country. I know it feels real great to get that kind of positive feedback from someone when you're putting out so much energy on stage.
We get that all the time, Tim. We're a band with a lot of energy. We love interacting with the crowd because that's what Corey likes to do, entertain. And so, you know, I've learned a lot from that. And, you know, you have to be a frontman when you're a lead singer. Well, you don't have to be, but, you know, it's kind of important as a lead singer to be a frontman. And so I had to learn how to be a front man. And so Corey and I work well together when we play.
Frank, before we get into what you are working on at present and even things that you are working on going into the future, I want to give you an opportunity to talk about what I would call a because of my blindness moment or achievement. So if you could tell me a couple things that you're the most proud of from your career, either with the post office or be baseball or anything you wish. What things have you done that you're most proud of that maybe you wouldn't have never done had you not been blind?
Probably be highlights for my beatball career. I haven't really been playing much over the last few years because of whatever, you know, not really health per se, but finances and time and everything else. But, you know, back in the early 2000s was pretty much my prime years, I guess you would say. And for 3 years in a row, I made the offensive all-star team. And in 2002, I got the offensive MVP in Chicago. And it was really interesting about that year was I almost didn't go to that World Series in Chicago. I almost didn't go, didn't have the money. But somehow I found a way to get the ticket to go, to fly out there. And, you know, had I not gone out there for that World Series, my team never would have made it to the championship round, the championship final day. And I would not have been the offensive MVP for that tournament. No, we didn't win that championship. They were both great games. But I'm not saying that because of me, they wouldn't have made it. But because of me, they did make it along with everybody else. And so it was awesome. And I've been playing, like I said, since 88, although I took a five-year layoff. And over the last couple of years, I played, but not consistently. So I'd like to give it one more try, you know, get in shape for a year. I was hoping to do it this year, but it's not going to happen. So maybe next year when I turn 60, I'd like to give it one more try and get in shape and just see if I could still play and go out there and roll around on the ground with the younger guys and gals that are playing this game and stuff. So, you know, beat baseball has been awesome. I still love the game. As far as my postal career, you know, getting to be in a couple weeks, 35 years at the post office. I do want to give you a couple of stats of me working on the DBCS for the last 24 years.
Okay.
So I, what I did was, when we process mail, Tim, on this machine, we average anywhere from like 15 to 25,000 pieces an hour. Okay. On an eight hour day. Of course, you got lunch and breaks. So it breaks down to 7 hours, 6 to 7 hours. So years ago, I was able to process in an 8 hour period, 245,000 pieces of mail in 1 8 hour shift with my partner. That's a lot of mail going through my hand. I've done over 200,000 pieces many, many times throughout the years, but although the mail has changed now, you just can't do it anymore. It just, because of the mail, has changed so much now. But I did a estimation of how much have I processed in the last 24 years? How much of my hands held all this mail and everything else? And so with a little bit of, you know, estimation and conservative numbers and everything else, for the last 24 years, Tim, I have probably processed over 600 million pieces of mail.
Wow. My goodness.
Yeah. More closer to 750 million pieces of mail that I have processed with my hands over the last 24 years.
That is a lot of mail.
That is a lot of mail.
Hell yeah.
A lot of mail. So, you know, that's an achievement in itself to be able to do that over a course of a career and everything else.
So as we've discussed your journey from childhood all the way up through now, we've talked about how you have found independence and sometimes found it again. When you were young, you liked playing basketball, were on the basketball team, and then later found beat baseball. And then, as you talked about early on in our conversation about being in choir in high school, and now here you are playing bass guitar in a country band. So sounds like over the years, whenever you've needed to, as you keep saying, just go with the flow, you find another way to yet again find your independence. And so here we are, basically almost to current time. Tell me about what's going on with you now. You've got the band going, obviously still long and strong and doing great with that. But what else are you doing with the band, with any other endeavors that you've got going on now and going forward?
You know, with the band, you know, we're still going strong, like I just said. And we love playing music. We love it. And we're still going to continue to do that. And if it comes to the point where we have to go our separate ways, there's always other musicians to play with. What I'm trying to do today, and what I've been trying to do over the last several years or whatever, is I know that there's a lot of unemployed blind people out there. And we see this in the community. You know, I've got a lot of blind friends that I've met over the years. So I'm always trying to find something that is accessible for us to do. Maybe not a 9-to-5 job, but maybe something that you can do from home and everything. And so I've been through several companies, you know, network marketing and things like that, and to try to find things that are accessible. And, you know, always you run into a brick wall and everything. And there are a couple that are somewhat doable, but you know, this one that I found now, and I won't get into too much information. If people want to ask me for some information, I'll be more than happy to help them out. But I think this business that I found is, I think, doable for us. I think we can do it. I think we can do it and make some money and become more independent in our finances and everything else. So I just want to say that I'm working at trying to see if this business is accessible for us. Can we do it? There's an app involved, which is great, and very minimal startup cost. Minimal. I mean, we're talking minimal. Minimal to the point where a cost of a night out is what it might cost. So that's nothing for us in this day and age. And so that's pretty much what I'm going to leave it at. But I mean, I think that there's something out there for us. I really think that if we have a good attitude and keep pushing forward, something will turn up. I mean, you know, we talked about all these different transitions in my life, and everything that I've done has been to the positive. I mean, can you imagine, had I not come out here to San Diego, Tim, I would not have met Rosie. I would not have met Corey and Laura. I wouldn't be in a band today had I stayed in Phoenix. I don't really, I really believe that I wouldn't be in a band today because of that.
A lot of things happen for a reason.
Yeah, a lot of things do happen for a reason. I mean, we met because of, you know, the Varel and whatever else. I mean, I'll mention that because that's how we met. But I mean, I may not have gotten involved in other blind activities outside of baseball. I mean, I'm not involved in any organizations or anything. But I mean, things do happen for a reason. And had I not come out here to San Diego, you know, who knows? I may not even be talking to you today because of the podcast. I have no idea. But things do happen for a reason. So I know that life is hard for anybody, but I think it's harder for us as blind people because of the job situation, having to learn Braille, having to deal with life way differently than people that can see. But to be honest with you, I wouldn't trade any other disability for the one I have today, because just because I'm blind, I could still do whatever I want, and I let nothing stop me. And I really believe that anybody listening to this, they shouldn't let anything stop them either, because they can get it done. I've proven that, you know, you've proven that. And there's a lot of other successful stories out there of blind people and that were either born blind or lost their eyesight as they got older, like myself. You know, there's a lot of other successful stories out there. So I really believe that by listening to these kind of podcasts like yours, you're bringing out these successes so these people, the blind community, can hear, well, wow, look at him, look what he did, or look what she did. If they can do it, I can do it. And I hope I can inspire that to somebody listening out there, that you can do it too. It can be done. Yeah, it's hard. It's going to be hard. But if you can push forward and push through that, there's nothing you can't do. There's, you know, pretty much the sky's the limit, Tim.
Very well said. I don't know that I could agree any more. And as you know, and everybody who listens to our podcast knows, that's our general message is, as I always say at the end of the regular podcast, you know, there truly can be a life after blindness. And it's just, how do we find that independence? How do we find the strength and the ability to do that and getting ourselves in a position where we can have that life after blindness? And I agree with you that your story shows that it can be done. And even though you may have to go through multiple transitions, multiple points in your life, asking different questions, finding out how it can be done, getting different accommodations if necessary, it may not be easy, as you just said. It may be very hard, but it definitely can be done. So I think that's very well said, and I hope that people take that message to heart.
Yeah, I do. I really believe that because you know, I look out for my blind friends. I wanna do whatever I can to help them out, and in any way that I can. You know, so anybody listening out there, if you want to reach out to me, feel free. It's just a community, and I want to share my experiences with these people so they know that, you know, there is something out there for you. Yes, jobs are hard. Jobs are hard for the blind. And hopefully with what I've got going on, maybe I can, you know, get some of them to possibly do this, you know, if that's what they want to do. But I mean, jobs are hard out there. So, but you still need to look for things to do out there. You still find something that you can do, whether it be a job or a talent or volunteer somewhere. I mean, do something, be part of the community, because it, you know, it is a lot easier, I really believe, for yourself and for your family, if you're out there and being active than being at home and always, you know, stressful or angry or sad or whatever. One quick thing I do want to say, my friend Joan Ellis that I talked about earlier in the podcast, we went to a seminar and there was a gal talking about her blindness, going blind with retinitis pigmentosa. And she had talked about her going blind 11 years earlier and she started crying. So she was really emotional about that. And I leaned over to Joan and I said that I feel bad that, you know, she'd gone through all this, but you know, I couldn't relate with her because I didn't go through that stuff. I was able to roll with the flow, so to speak, you know. And but some people take it harder than others. Some people take it better than others. So that's why we, meaning you and myself and other people, we need to show these people that, you know, there is life after blindness and there are things you can do out there, and just reach out, you know, and ask for help. That's the important thing. Just reach out and ask for help, because there's somebody out there on the other end that is willing to do whatever they can to help you out.
Absolutely. And now, that being said, if anybody would want to get in contact with you, Frank, as we're wrapping up here, how can they do that? How can they get a hold of you if they want to find out more about your life, more about your story, more about Steel Horse Country? What ways can they get in contact with you?
You know, I'm on Facebook, so you know, Frank Facio on Facebook and F-A-C-I-O. You can find my band on Facebook. It's Steel Horse Country, and I'll spell that because I spell it a little bit differently. Steel Horse is S-T as in Tom, E-E, L as in Larry, E again, H-O-R-S-E, so that's Steel Horse, and then Country, two separate words. And you'll find us on Facebook. There'll be some videos out there. We got YouTube videos. That's under Steel 581. That's S-T-E-E-L-E 581. We got some videos out there. Steel Horse SD on Twitter. You know, things like that. We're all over the place. Also, if you want to send me an email, my email address is bigfoz58@gmail.com, and I'll spell that for you. That's B as in boy, I, G as in George, F as in Frank, A, Z as in zebra, 58@gmail.com. So that's bigfoz58@gmail.com. They can get a hold of me there because I check my emails all the time. And that's pretty much it. That's how they can get a hold of me. And so what I would like to say, Tim, is thank you very much for having me on this interview. I really appreciate it. It means a lot to me, and hopefully I can inspire at least one person out there listening to this, if not more. But I really appreciate what you're doing for us and your podcast, and I hope this continues on. But, you know, again, I want to thank you for having me on the show and telling my story.
Well, you're very welcome, Frank, and I do really appreciate you coming on and talking with me and the audience and telling your story and helping us on the podcast in the past. And so, again, thank you very much for coming on, and I'm sure we'll be seeing more of you down the road.
Again, thank you guys very much, and have an incredible life.
This has been my interview with Frank Facio on the Life After Blindness Spotlight. Thank you so much for listening. And to close out the podcast, let's go ahead and take a listen to one more song by Steel Horse Country. This is Heard It in a Love Song, which features Frank's wife Rosie on the flute.
can't be wrong.